Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I fly like Piper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make a more day. I get one down in a second if you wait.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we can continue our series, The Eights, a brief history of the culture wars, decade by decade.
Sometimes I think sitting on trains, every step I get to, I'm clocking that game. Everyone's a winner.
And now we come to 2008. 10 years ago, not most remembered for that song Paper Planes, but one of the tunes from then for a little 08 blast from the past. But it was yet another pivotal year that ended in 8. Remember some of the places we've been in this series. In 1948, the international systems of trade and human rights standards were codified. Now they are both challenged by the divisions of today. And in 1948, television became a mass medium with such vast cultural implications, both unifying and dividing. In 1968, the world was rocked by the King and Kennedy assassinations, the protests in the U.S. and Europe, the Chicago Convention, and more, and Richard Nixon was elected president. In 1998, President Clinton was impeached, a result of in many ways of the polarizing culture wars. And in 2008 came the financial crisis that started in earnest on September 15th, 2008, that has defined the economy ever since in many ways. And of course, the United States elected Barack Obama, the first black president in a country whose history was defined so much by slavery and racial discrimination, who was elected with the hope that he was from a new generation, too, a post-Clinton and Bush generation, as many people saw it, poised to forge a new post-culture wars beginning.
If this financial crisis taught us anything, it's that we cannot have a thriving Wall Street while Main Street suffers. In this country, we rise or fall as one nation, as one people. Let's resist the temptation to fall back on the same partisanship and pettiness.
That was Obama from his victory speech in Chicago's Grant Park on election night 2008. Some hopes were later realized, but many have been dashed. But so, in 2008, came the end of the George W. Bush administration, which had been more polarizing than Bush had hoped, and with Bush and Cheney very unpopular by the end, enough so that Bush made this self-deprecating joke about leaving office at the 2008 White House Correspondents' Dinner.
After he left office, Vice President Gore won an Oscar and the Nobel Peace Prize. Hey, I don't know, I might win a prize, a publishing clearinghouse or something.
And, of course, Vice President Gore, who he referred to there, won the popular vote in 2000 in what was then one of the most polarizing moments in presidential election history, the Bush versus Gore recount and Supreme Court case. Another joke from that era was that Bush won a very close election. It was 5-4. Now, Bush never wanted it to be that way. He ran for president calling himself a uniter, not a divider, and he ran on what he hoped could be a domestic policy framework that could unify left and right, or at least split the difference, what he early on called compassionate conservatism.
Government cannot solve every problem, but it can encourage people and communities to help themselves and to help one another. Often the truest kind of compassion is to help citizens build lives of their own. I call my philosophy and approach compassionate conservatism. It is compassionate to actively help our fellow citizens in need. It is conservative to insist on responsibility and on results. And with this hopeful approach, we can make a real difference in people's lives.
Bush in 2002. That was meant in part to be a contrast with the hardest edge of the religious right, like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. Remember where they pointed their fingers after 9/11? Falwell speaks first.
I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur.
Well, Pat Robertson totally concurring with Jerry Falwell there on what contributed to the 9/11 attacks. So Bush was trying to be not that. The Iraq War, his tax cuts that benefited the wealthy so much, and some of Bush's religious right tendencies of his own, would further divide the nation, as it turned out. But unlike Trump, his original game plan was not divide and conquer. Take, for example, Bush's famous remarks about Islam just 6 days after the September 11th attacks, so different from our federal government today. This is worth replaying a minute of. This is from September 17th, 2001.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace. These terrorists don't represent peace. They represent evil and war. When we think of Islam, we think of a faith that brings comfort to a billion people around the world. Billions of people find comfort and solace and peace. And that's made brothers and sisters out of every race, out of every race. America counts millions of Muslims amongst our citizens. And Muslims make an incredibly valuable contribution to our country.
President Bush, just after 9/11, can you imagine Trump giving that speech? But just before it, before the attacks that changed the world and everybody's priorities, much of the spotlight on Bush was how religious right he would be. The attacks of September made most people forget that during August, the big issue was whether he would impose his own religious beliefs on science by banning embryonic stem cell research. And he sort of did, with an end to federal funding for medical science based on new lines of those cells. Funding could continue for research based on existing lines. Medical researchers were not happy, but Bush framed it as a moral dilemma.
Research offers hope that millions of our loved ones may be cured of a disease and rid of their suffering. I have friends whose children suffer from juvenile diabetes. Nancy Reagan has written me about President Reagan's struggle with Alzheimer's. My own family has confronted the tragedy of childhood leukemia. And like all Americans, I have great hope for cures. I also believe human life is a sacred gift from our Creator. I worry about a culture that devalues life, and believe, as your president, I have an important obligation to foster and encourage respect for life in America and throughout the world.
Bush on August 9th, 2001. His religious beliefs would come into play again in 05 in the culturally divisive Terry Schiavo case, the question was, who had the legal right to decide whether to end the life of Schiavo by removing the feeding tube from her? She had been in a vegetative state for 15 years. Bush's position was that even under those circumstances, only God could decide.
I urge all those who honor Terry Schiavo to continue to work to build a culture of life where all Americans are welcomed and valued and protected, especially those who live at the mercy of others. The essence of civilization is that the strong have a duty to protect the weak. Cases where there are serious doubts and questions, the presumption should be in the favor of life.
Bush in 2005. Now, one of his daughters, Jenna Bush, surprised people after he left office by saying George W. Bush was a feminist. He certainly did not have that reputation in office, enacting anti-abortion policies and more. But here's how Jenna Bush justified her claim to Entertainment Weekly last year.
I think the thing that my parents did so well and might surprise people, although I don't know why, is that they really wanted us to be curious, independent thinkers. They wanted to raise us to have our own views and to be able to articulate them.
Talking about she and her sister, Jenna Bush, last year. So this week on The Eights, we'll talk about the financial crisis and the culture wars tomorrow, about Obama and the culture wars on Thursday with Donna Brazile. Today, how much did George W. Bush contribute to the culture wars before the election of Obama in 2008? My guest for today is longtime Bush supporter and someone who you might say has two generations of culture wars experience. John Podoritz is a staple of the conservative press, a New York Post columnist, Weekly Standard contributor, and editor of Commentary magazine. Some of you know that his father, Norman Podoritz, was also editor of Commentary from 1960 to 1995. And Norman Podoritz was a major culture wars figure in his heyday. He was one of the original so-called neoconservatives, that is, people who used to consider themselves liberal, but then got disillusioned with the left. In fact, let's replay, before we bring on John, part of a clip that we aired last week in this series of Norman Podoritz talking on C-SPAN in 1999 about his book, whose title says a lot, Ex-Friends, Falling Out with Allen Ginsberg, Lionel and Diana Trilling, Lillian Hellman, Hannah Arendt, and Norman Mailer.
You know, I was hated much more than people who were then to the right of me, say like Bill Buckley, since he had always been a an enemy. I was a new enemy, and I regarded all my old friends as a continuing threat to what much of what I now believed and held dear, and so it was a kind of non-negotiable difference, not just of opinion about small matters or particularities, but of a whole sense of life, a whole sense of the world, you know, and but it mainly focused on the nature and character of American society.
So Norman Podoritz went from FDR to Reagan. His son John Podoritz went from Reagan and W to being a never Trump conservative today. In 2004, he published a book called Bush Country: How W Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. John, thanks for being part of this series and welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Can you talk a little first about your father's life and times, and in brief, what drove him to cross a kind of culture war divide back in the 1950s? He said in that clip that it was
the late 60s, early 70s.
Sorry about that.
So there were interlocking reasons, and I would direct listeners to go to Commentary Magazine's website now and read a piece we just published by two scholars of New York City about the 1968 school strikes around Ocean Hill Brownsville in Brooklyn, because that is a very illuminating way to understand locally one of the key issues that drove certain people on the left in New York, like my father, rightward, in that the culture war there was a battle over control of the New York City schools that turned extremely ugly between African-American activists and teachers who were at the time close to a majority of whom were Jewish, and the teachers union was opposed, led by Al Shanker, was opposed to efforts to fire teachers en masse in Ocean Hill Brownsville when they got the chance to run the school district. And Shanker took the New York City school teachers out on strike, and the response was vitriolic and extremely ugly, and that was an early example of the, I'm not sure culture war is the right term, sort of social political war that had broken out in the United States in the late 1960s. And the question, and it was thought, and I think the piece demonstrates that it was thought properly, that the activists crossed the line from Pan-Africanism into anti-Semitism in their objections to Shanker's actions and to the rhetoric in which the fight was conducted. So that article, the 1968 School Strike Revisited, gives you a real flavor of the kinds of divisions that made people on the left say, well, this is not, I can no longer associate myself with certain people who seem to be in the vanguard on the liberal side, and I now need to look elsewhere. So that was one example. There were others. You know, the term culture war, I'm sure you probably reflected on this in your series in the 90s, you know, the phrase adapted to American politics was really introduced by Pat Buchanan in 1992, mm-hmm. In which I think he blended together social, cultural, and political concerns with this idea that it wasn't just that the left and the right disagreed, but that their frame of references were so divided that there was that war was an appropriate analogy to explain the very different ideas about how America should conduct itself and be constituted. So a lot of those earlier battles were really policy battles: how to handle the Soviet Union, how to deal with issues like affirmative action and quotas and matters that seem to have receded in the national consciousness, but were at the forefront of the general discussion. But now a lot of it, particularly now, and I think we saw a lot of this emerge during the decade, I don't even know what you call it, the aughts or something.
That'll do.
But now in their full flowering, really is a culture war in the sense that, you know, we're fighting over football players, we're fighting over Tony Award speeches.
Right.
We're fighting over things that often seem very... would have been understood in different times to have been sort of like beside the point or silly things for, you know, serious people to obsess over. And now they really have become sort of front and center in the American political conversation.
So how would you look back on President George W. Bush's original approach to culture war type issues when he ran for president in 2000, 8 years after that Pat Buchanan speech, calling himself a compassionate conservative?
Right. Well, I disagree with you in one respect in your otherwise excellent long introduction, which is I don't think compassionate conservatism was directed at the religious right. It was directed at Newt Gingrich. It was directed at the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994, and the policies that were enumerated in a couple of years afterward that, in just stark political terms, turned off a lot of suburban women. So when Bush started to, and his speechwriter Mike Gerson started to formulate the compassionate conservative theme, they were trying to separate themselves from what looked like a kind of ugly, tough-minded, and not particularly religious conservatism in which, you know, Medicare was cut and Medicaid was cut and you didn't want to fund anything. And so he was trying to come up with a spin that said, I'm not one of those guys. Mm-hmm. In the most startling moment of that, in a speech in 1999 at the Manhattan Institute, Bush took specific aim at Robert Bork, who had written a book called Slouching Toward Gomorrah, the rejected Supreme Court nominee in the 1980s, leading conservative legal figure. And Bush actually sort of made fun of or attacked the phrase slouching toward Gomorrah. America is not slouching toward Gomorrah. And he said... And so I think he was going at a different... He was trying to say, basically, to American women, you can vote for me. I'm not Newt Gingrich.
You know, I tend to think Bush and Obama have at least one thing in common. They set out to be unifiers, not dividers, and they got hoisted on the underlying intensity of American culture wars and political polarization. How much would you agree with that?
I think that's a very fair point. I mean, I think Obama, of course, comes along as a reaction and a replacement for Bush, and promises unity. But by the time he becomes president, unity is a fig leaf. And he, in fact, in Obama's first year, doesn't really need to pursue unity because he had such an overwhelming majority in Congress. You know, had 60 senators, until the untimely death of Teddy Kennedy, that he could push through legislation at will and the Republicans could do nothing about it. So that one difference was that Bush came into office as a 50-50, you know, literally a 50-50 president, and with a Senate that swung, that was, you know, 50-50 until the middle of the first year of his office, when Republican senator from Rhode Island switched parties, and then he didn't have the Senate, and then he got the Senate back in 2002. So, you know, for him, any success that he needed before 9/11, particularly in his signature piece of legislation, No Child Left Behind, which was, you know,
with Ted Kennedy. Reform. With Ted Kennedy.
Yeah, he had to pursue it with Ted Kennedy, because otherwise he would not, you know, he could not get the votes to pass, nor could he get the votes even to achieve the right in the Senate for the whole Senate to vote on the bill. So he was forced into unity by political circumstance. And I think it was also his, Bush cited a lot the fact that in Texas, as governor, he had made, he had established a good working relationship with the Democratic head of the legislature, Bob Bullock. Of course, the Texas Democratic Party of the time was a species different from the Democratic Party in Washington in 2001, or the Democratic Party now was much closer to the Republican Party ideologically. But, I mean, that was his dream. His idea was that, you know, they could find common ground. And, in fact, after 9/11, to be fair, and through the first vote on the Iraq War, there was unity even after, you know, even as the there was an enormous amount of American unity. The Patriot Act passed, you know, with very little Democratic opposition, and half the Democratic senators voted for the Iraq War, effectively. I mean, there was no specific vote for the Iraq War, but they effectively voted for the Iraq War.
Authorized.
And the authorization to go to war right after 9/11 against Al-Qaeda, that we're still using.
Yeah.
You know, I carry the AUMF, which is still being used today to allow for operations in Afghanistan. All that had bipartisan support.
Now, listeners, for our oral history call-in on the 8th today, we'll invite anyone who voted for George W. Bush for president at least once to call in and remember why, in your opinion, and how did he or did he not help lead to Donald Trump. 212-433-WNYC. In the context of our Culture War series, how did George W. Bush, there are so many things we could talk about with respect to Bush, but this isn't the total history of George W. Bush. This is in the context of our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. How did or did not George Bush contribute to leading to the force really in Republican America that elected Donald Trump and supports him now? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, with John Podoritz, who, among other things, when we continue after the break, will ask how he went from being such a Bush supporter to being a never Trump Republican. As we continue on the 8th, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and we'll hear some more historical audio as well right after this.
Kansas gonna get me bombed. Do no good to say what you are. I run the streets and I break up houses. River runs deep and the flame devours it. Me, I'm a
David Byrne from 2008, Strange Overtones. We continue with the 8s, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. Today we're in 2008, specifically on how much did George W. Bush contribute to the culture wars before the election of Obama in 2008, with John Podoritz, editor of Commentary, columnist at the New York Post and contributing editor for the Weekly Standard. One issue on which Bush was certainly not a Trumpian-style conservative was on immigration. He pushed comprehensive immigration reform, but it failed in Congress. Here's Bush on Latino identity in a 2000 campaign commercial.
I'm a young Latino in the U.S. and very proud of my bloodline. In many ways, I'm like any other American. I believe in opportunity, a level playing field for everyone, and the achievement of the American dream. I have an uncle that is running for president because he believes in the same thing, opportunity for every American, for every Latino. His name, same as mine, George Bush.
I'm proud of the Latino blood that flows in the Bush family. As a consequence, I've learned about the culture, a bit about the language, and a lot about the Latino character. I've learned that my values and Latino values are the same, conservative values.
So obviously I should have set that up by saying that it was going to be two George Bushes, but you got the idea if you heard it. John, so that was a campaign commercial circa 2000. How much is today's Republican Party, in your opinion, with vast support for Trump among the rank and file nationwide, a result of Bush and his allies not being anti-immigration enough?
Well, I think you have pinpointed one of the pivot issues in you know, as you say, the culture war, and that Bush was a despite the fact that everybody sort of referred to, you know, insisted that he was a horrible unilateralist, was in fact not a unilateralist, was pretty much a multilateralist who believed in the Western Alliance and working together, and he was a, I guess what you would call a liberal on immigration, and it was one of his goals to advance new forms of immigration reform. I think one of the interesting aspects of the criticisms of Bush from the left in the 2000s is that you can see, you can hate the Iraq War all you like, but I think you can see that there was an idea expressed on the left about Bush that was not real and was not accurate about him, but is accurate about Trump. In other words, the caricature of Bush that inflamed Republicans, inflamed Democrats and liberals and the left in the 2000s has actually come to actual fruition in Trump. That is to say, what all the things that people criticized Bush for being, you know, unilateralist, for being uncaring, for not being interested in alliances, for, you know, demoralizing our politics, and for somehow being, I don't think anyone really thought that he was, you know, hostile to immigrants, but, you know, certainly not that was not something for which he was given a lot of credit. Trump is the caricature of Bush, you know, Trump is the real version of the caricature of Bush from the 2000s, which is a fascinating development.
It's,
you know,
a very interesting observation. And I guess the liberal pushback would be, did Bush not contribute to the Trumpian grassroots sense of constant grievance? He was with us or against us on the war on terror. Compared to his father, the first President Bush, he was more religious right. He was perceived as having this cowboy smirk, anti-intellectual grounding, like Trump said he didn't read books, and things like that.
Right. But see, that's the thing. Bush did read books. Bush didn't watch television. Bush only read books. Bush was a religious right-nick because he was a believer, not because he was somebody who was, you know, peddling his wares as a non-believing, you know, twice divorced sybarite to religious right-nicks saying, you know, come with me and I'll give you as much power as you want. In fact, often you've cited a couple of cases in which he, you know, his views conformed with the religious right, or kind of, in the case of Terry Schiavo and stem cells. But in fact, the stem cell decision, the religious right was disappointed that Bush did not go all that far in helping Terry Schiavo, number one. And the stem cell decision was an effort to kind of split the baby on stem cells. Mm-hmm. And he often, and particularly in the case of immigration, used biblical or, you know, religious right rhetoric to attack his own side. I mean, he said of immigration, he said he would preach the gospel of the you know, he would tell the story of the Good Samaritan. When you are not allowed to let the stranger, you're not allowed to pass the stranger who is suffering on the road. You know, that is a sin. Talk like that was an effort to go after religious right on its own terms, kind of from the left. Mm-hmm. So he was a more complex figure mm-hmm. on these matters than he was ever given mm-hmm. credit for in the midst of the tough culture war that I think emerged from the fact that so many people had difficulty letting go of what happened when the Supreme Court ended the recounts in Florida and gave him the yeah. presidency.
Mark in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi. You know, I voted for W. Bush twice, you know, moderate Republican. And to me, I would say now, by the way, the quiet dignity with which he presents himself now as an ex-president is in marked contrast to the current president. That's just an aside. But I think his presidency would be looked at very favorably were it not for the mistake of the Iraq War. I mean, that to me is the seminal event of his presidency. Obviously, the financial crisis at the end also has a tarnish, but that was a worldwide event that, you know, perhaps, you know, no one person really, you know, is responsible for, but he was responsible for that decision, and that unfortunately I think marks everything else about the man. But to me, he's a wonderful individual, a great ex-president, and a role model in many respects.
Mark, I'm curious, did you vote for Trump?
No, because character matters to me, and I will not could not consider voting for a man of with his character.
So you don't see Bush as having led to Trump in any way, certainly not being consistent with Trump, but not led to Trump either?
No way. I see it as a lifelong Republican. I'm admittedly a moderate, but I mean, I'm sort of in the Bush family camp of, if you want to call that, the, mm-hmm. the Mitt Romney Bush mm-hmm. Bush camp of the Republican Party. I mean, I see nothing in the current president that speaks to me.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Mike in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Thanks, Brian. I think that you guys have got this whole paradigm wrong, and having Mr. Podhoretz on sort of embodies it. Donald Trump, I voted for Bush, and I voted for Donald Trump, and I must say I'm much happier with the results than I thought I would be. I was principally voting against Hillary Clinton. The fact of the matter is that Donald Trump, like Ronald Reagan, are reactions to a period of really unrealistic behavior on the part of our government. You don't have to like what he's saying, but part of what's going on here, and it's been throughout this entire series, is this perpetuation of the Trump is a crazy, stupid, idiot model.
Well, we really haven't been talking about Trump in this series, and I don't want to really talk about him now, except, Mike, to hear from you as a Bush voter, if there were particular disappointments that you had with Bush that led you to, or that contributed to you voting for Trump rather than winding up like the previous caller.
Okay, well, I was attempting to answer that. The fact is that the manner in which Bush handled the growing financial crisis was detached from reality. Okay, the manner in fact, I would argue that we had 16 years of detached from reality governance. Okay, people reacted to that. All right, by going for something that sounded a little bit more realistic, much the way they did in 1980 when they looked at the Great Society and particularly mm-hmm. the form it took in the 70s and said, this isn't working. Okay, and that represents to a large degree the cultural reaction that people like Mr. Podhoretz still haven't been able to get a handle on it. And an example of that, where did they hold the summit with Kim Il-sung? They held it in Singapore for a specific reason,
Kim Jong-un,
because
yeah.
Singapore is a model of a country run by a dictatorial family that looks a heck of a lot more attractive to its citizens than Korea, North Korea. Do you think that was just an accident?
But what are you saying? Are you supporting Singapore-style dictatorship?
Excuse me? Well, again, this is what I'm talking about in terms of reality, okay? Obviously, a dictatorship is bad. This was a good example of this was in the 1980s. If you may recall, Brian, the whole argument between authoritarian versus totalitarian regimes, okay? If you're going to move a guy who's dictator for life in a positive direction, suggesting that that solution, as Bolton said with the Libya example, is going to involve him losing power, you're not going to get anything done. So if you're going to be realistic, you're going to say, let's see how we can move this guy in a better direction, in a way that could really happen, rather than one that merely sounds good, so we can convince ourselves of our own personal virtue.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. John, how do you want to react to either of those callers?
Well, okay, so I think the first call, I guess, Mark, was it Mark from Westchester? So, I mean, it's obviously the case that the Bush presidency founders in Iraq, and that Iraq is what, you know, is the reason that Barack Obama outdistanced Hillary Clinton. Aside from everything else, people sort of forget the point about Obama's candidacy was not just that he would be the first black president, he was a progressive and everything, but that he had spoken out against the war and Hillary Clinton had voted for the war. And that was the signature issue for the Democratic Party.
Right.
So he's obviously right that, you know, Obama's a reaction to Bush and to the fact that the war in Iraq was not won, and that 3 years after Saddam had toppled, the country, you know, fell into a really brutal and barbaric civil war. I think the second caller, I very much understand why Trump became president, and I understand what it is that appeals to the people who support him. I don't find it difficult at all, and I think most of it has to do with the culture war and the fact that one of the things that Trump does is say everything that you have been victimized by the liberal culture in the United States, and I am your voice. I'm giving voice to you. So you don't like it when people don't stand up for the flag. I'm going to spend 6 months attacking football players who take a knee. Now, to a lot of people, like I say, this is not, you know, this is unbecoming of a president who has a lot more important things to be dealing with.
So what changed? And then we're going to be out of time, because you might have been among, and look at all the never Trump conservatives on television these days who are more likely to show up on MSNBC than on Fox.
Right, well, that's George, me too.
What I'm saying. And George Will and Charlie Sykes and Nicole Wallace, who was Bush's communications director, and, you know, Joe Scarborough. But because you might have said that a lot of America's problems have to do with liberalism.
Well, I do think that a lot of America's problems have to do with liberalism. I don't think that this is a particularly fertile approach to handling those problems, which I think Trump deals with almost entirely in symbolic fashion and not in practical fashion. And I also think that, you know, when it comes to, for example, this inventive reading of the placement of the summit in Singapore, which I am almost positive didn't occur to anybody who decided to put it in Singapore, but it's an inventive reading. If Trump were the sort of president who sent subtle esoteric messages of this sort through his, you know, presidency, that would be a different presidency from the one we see, which is very blunt and plain and clear and says what it says. That's the virtue of it, if you think that it's a virtue, because, you know, you can't mistake him for anybody else, and he doesn't seem to say anything all that much that he doesn't mean. So that's his, you know, that's his calling card. I don't really call myself a never Trumper anymore. I didn't like the term, because it was basically a hashtag, and I think politics shouldn't be run by hashtag.
It's a good
there are things he does that I support, what I called myself sometimes a hardly ever Trumper or something like that. There are things that he's
done
that I support.
Too many characters.
Right, but every time he does something that I support, 5 minutes later he says something on Twitter that makes me want to, you know, bang my head against the wall. So I don't, you know.
I hear you.
And, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, and there's a lot to unpack for everybody. And I think ultimately, what 2008 tells us about Trump is that the key to understanding how Trump made it, and I think this the caller got this right, is that there was no reckoning really politically for the 2008 crash. It happened in September, 6 weeks before an election. Nobody was blamed. There was no reckoning. And so you couldn't really blame Obama for it. You could blame his responses to it if they didn't, you know, didn't help the economy recover as quickly as the economy needed to be. But there was a revolutionary feeling in this country for basically a lost decade of earnings. And you saw it in the Republican Party, in Trump, because everybody else running for president in 2016 basically said, well, we should do this, and we should do that, and we should do the other thing. And nobody said everything in this country got bollocksed up. And the same thing in the Democratic Party, where Sanders basically said, nobody paid for this. And you went and you talked to Goldman Sachs, Hillary Clinton, and you were siding with the enemy of the American people. And those two messages, those populist messages, it was going to come out at some point. If the meltdown had happened in 2007, the 2008 election would have pivoted entirely on the meltdown.
And tying it up,
2012 didn't either.
Tying it up with a bow by bringing it all back to 2008, John Podoretz, editor of commentary, columnist at the New York Post, contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, and a surprisingly frequent, by let's say 2015 standards, guest on MSNBC. John, thank you very much for contributing to our series, The Eights.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.
Slow it down to a screeching halt. Impeach the president, cause he don't think before he talk. Iraq got that, now he gunning for Iran. North Korea got that that make LA look like Japan. Island, nah man, more like the Caribbean. Billy Ocean, body potent, take up all your...